From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. This episode is part two of our Forests Over Profits series, featuring excerpts from our Forests Over Profits conference and protest this past September. If you're not familiar with the series, here's what you need to know real quick. This September, the Coast Range Association, in partnership with many other amazing organizations, organized a series of protests and a day-long Forests Over Profits conference in response to a corporate timberland investment conference called, and this is their title, Who Will Own the Forest? Their answer is, of course, they will. Who Will Own the Forest brings together some of the world's biggest climate polluters, corporate clear-cutters, finance giants, and false climate solutions peddlers to network and scheme on how to extract maximum short-term returns while devastating our communities and the climate. If you want to learn more about the Who Will Own the Forest conference specifically, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to the episode I did a few weeks back called Who Will Own the Forest with Brenna Bell. And you can find that on the Coast Range Radio podcast feed. Or you can also learn more at forestsoverprofits.org. Okay, back to today's episode. Today we're going to hear from Coast Range Association Executive Director Chuck Willer. Chuck spoke about the groundbreaking work Coast Range Association has done, highlighting the devastating role that Wall Street-style capitalism has played here in the Northwest, his Green New Deal for Forests proposal, and new directions his research is taking him. You can learn more about everything discussed here today and a lot more at coastrange.org. Okay, let's jump right in with an introduction by Brenna Bell of 350 PDX.
My name is Brenna Bell. I'm the Forest Climate Manager for 350 PDX and part of the Forest Climate Alliance, which has helped with today's conference. For some of us, this is day two of the Forests Over Profits mobilization. For some of us, this is day three. People have been engaged in a variety of rallies and protests and songs and skits and chants and direct confrontation with people up there on the hill at the Who Will Own the Forests conference. And that's been a lot of no. We've been speaking about what it's like to have capitalist exploitation of the land and the impact of that. But we wanted to couple our no with a yes, right? We wanted to say, no, we don't want capitalist and colonial relationships with land, but what do we want? And so today we are leaning into that. And I do want to recognize that we are here today on the land of the Chinook of the Willamette Valley. Right, people who lived in right relationship from the land for time immemorial until settler colonization interrupted that flow of relations. And this land got filled with people who were far away from their own ancestral lands and didn't know how to be here. And they didn't know how to listen to the land, and they didn't know how to listen to the people. And so much has been broken, and so much has been lost. But the land's still here. And this land is fecund. It grows things. It is resilient. And its people are still here. The Chinook people fighting for federal recognition right now are still here, and they are resilient and they're resurgent. And it is our opportunity to be allies in that fight for the land and the people. And there's a lot of us here who are second comers, who want to do it differently than our ancestors did when they got here and didn't listen and didn't learn from the land and the people. And I think that's what draws us in today, because we want to do things better. We know that healing is possible and that we can do it. So that's why we're here today. That's the journey we'll be on, the learning journey together. And we'll talk about ways to live with the land that are not enmeshed in capitalism, that are not enmeshed in settler colonialism, ways to live in reciprocity to the land and enrich our lives and not our pockets, right? That's what they're doing up there, is filling their pockets. But we want to fill our hearts and fill our relations and draw that out to the land. So today we'll hear from a lot of really cool people who work with the forest and with policies and with legal systems, but with an eye towards right relationships. And the first of those people I'm gonna hand the mic over to is Chuck Willer. Without Chuck, honestly, none of this would be happening. Chuck is the executive director of the Coast Range Association and was one of the first people to start digging into that question of the financialization of the forests. So in 1996, Chuck published the first Coast Range Association ownership analysis of big timberland owners. And then in 2001, re-upped that with a proposal for new forestry. Chuck's been doing a lot of this good no and yes, right? Digging into the Wall Street money that's being funneled into the forest and then coming up with solutions for it. Also created a really cool map in 2016 that I still use as a reference today that shows how ownership has moved into corporations and out of local areas and how that has impacted taxing districts, local communities. So today Chuck gets to talk about the yes. What land reform looks like, what a Green New Deal for Oregon forests would look like.
Yes, I'm supposed to speak here today about the Green New Deal proposal we came out with a month or so before the pandemic hit, which was unfortunate. And I realized that I didn't have a presentation on the proposal because I stopped doing public speaking. And so I had to put something together here at the last minute and tried to bring it up to speed. So that's just a little context. I'm trying to lower expectation here, which is to my advantage. So before I even want to start out on my few slides, I want to give a shout out to the spray opponents, forest defenders down in Beaver Creek, Seal Rock, some of which are here. Would you stand up if you're from Lincoln County, Seal Rock? There we go. The ballot measure that they got passed, where the voters voted to ban aerial spraying from helicopters, of course, was overturned by preemption in the courts. And now an owner from Europe who owns 3,000 acres in that area and lives in a castle was going to spray and clear cut and then sell out, the word was. And a lot of folks hadn't heard that the preemption had been overturned it and thought everything was fine. Well, they've mobilized quite a group down in the Seal Rock, Beaver Creek area from Waldport to Newport. And it just shows the strength of grassroots mobilization when you've taken the time to educate a population about an issue, the toxic legacy of pesticides, which every year new information comes out, just validating what people like Carol Van Strom were talking about 25 years ago. So that's that. So I'm going to be speaking to the Green New Deal proposal. I was speaking out in communities before we rolled this out and while I worked on it, and I just want to go through a few slides and a setup that is background to what went into the thinking on this. And of course, the fact that we're in a climate emergency was the main thing that motivated me and people at that time and the Green New Deal proposal. As Brenna mentions, I'd worked a long time on financial forest owners and real estate investment trust, the transition from industrial regular corporate owners vertically integrated to real estate investment trust or timber investment management organizations was really what we mapped. I mapped in 2016. I can't go into like why is that big to see that transition, but it certainly links Wall Street money directly into the firm in a special way. And around that time, I think I started using the phrase that these folks grow money, not forest. Maybe I thought of that a long time ago. I don't know. But anyway, it certainly encapsulates the whole problem. You know, one of the things that this goes back all the way to 2001 in our work we did back then was the difference between the financial forests and the natural forests. Now, we're not going back to a natural forest anytime soon on the industrial lands, but you can see the potential to sequester carbon on industrial lands because they're so tiny today with their short rotation. And of course, at the time the Green New Deal came out and everyone was talking about, there was quite a climate awareness upsurge. What I was thinking about at that time were proposals equal to the emergency. A lot of people were talking and speculating about things, but it just didn't seem like they were talking at the scale of what we were up against. So I wanted to think at, you know, what would be a scale that level. And then Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey came out with House Resolution, and it was a Senate resolution, House Resolution 109, which laid out the framework for a Green New Deal that would be adopted by the federal government. Only the federal government can do the kind of transition, finance it, et cetera, lead it, that was necessary to transform the whole industrial social framework that we operate on into something that would be compatible with solutions to the climate emergency. So I pulled off that and just focused on, okay, here's the climate emergency, the Green New Deal, House Resolution 109, just transition, a lot of recommendations there, remove carbon. And I think, I don't know, spent 3 or 4 months writing the Coast Range Association proposal, Climate Oregon's Industrial Forest, a Green New Deal proposal. You can download this as a PDF off the Coast Range website. I hope everyone has or will. And I like it. And I think it scales to what we were talking about back then or what's needed today. Something's really serious and profound, which is to throw the bums off the forest land that come from Wall Street and replace it with something else, which I'll talk about. But one of the things that I had gotten into before doing this work and really helped inform, easily roll into this just transition framework for me, is that we had been looking at socioeconomic factors out in the rural landscape for a long time, talking about it. I remember going to Forest Coalition meetings, I don't know, 2010, 2000, whatever, and bringing up social issues and Wall Street issues, and just like, blank look. That's all you get back. Nothing going to happen. We're going to talk about, you know, the things that the environmental community talks about. So I had this background, and one of the things we had looked at is the analysis done by the United Way, which went beyond the poverty metrics and looked at metrics for every census area out there of households that are living hand to mouth. In other words, they were working, they get their paycheck, it'd be gone by the next paycheck, and they were just one small emergency away from disaster financially. And some of the numbers out there, for like Rockaway Beach, 56% of the households are in that stressed condition or in poverty. And so we were looking at that, and I used that in the Green New Deal. I used it in other things, and it was an example of appreciating the stress condition economically of people in the rural United States. Part and parcel with this appreciation of the stress condition is I knew we were losing population out in the rural area. I mean, I knew that because I had some comparative numbers between 1990 and 2000, but I didn't have these numbers spatially determined up until the 2020 census. And the Forest Service had done this, had laid out the GIS framework for doing a new analysis, but then didn't want to incorporate the new data, which was a huge data set, and I couldn't do it. And I had mentioned to Professor Kelly Kay at UCLA, who is here today, this problem, and she put me in touch with a student of hers, Spencer, who took huge data sets and applied them to from 1990 to 2020. And what does it say? We looked at it, and from between 1990 and 2020, almost the entire landscape of Oregon that's rural lost population or had population growth less than half of the state's average. The only places in the state that had any growth, which is a reflection of economic activity, is the dark areas. And it's basic, if you want to see the data that suggests why fascist reactionary political tendencies find fertile ground in the rural area, all you have to do is look at the demographic shift and that stress condition in the United Way data, and you know you've got a problem. And I talked about this to many people, that the policy needs to address this from the top to the bottom, and the Green New Deal House Resolution 109, it knew that. That's what it was about. spending the appropriate funds on transitioning the whole country and urban areas too. I mean, it goes both ways. So this is all background to sitting down to, or why I was writing this proposal. And another interesting thing that I like is that I went into the structure and the conditions within the timber industry. And the fact that it's subcontracted, they deunionized in the 80s, they shed workers and rehired contractors who had the workers now. And it's just a nightmare out there for the timber workers. And they're in all these little isolated companies that bid against each other. That's just a structural institutional setup for turning the screws down. And recently, Weyerhaeuser had a strike by its union members. It's a reflection of the screws they've been turning down on forest workers. And I had a nice piece about log truck drivers and the stress conditions they work under. So that was important to, I think, describe as prelude to saying, well, where can we go? It wasn't a brilliant insight. We had an example previously of the federal government creating community-based enterprise all over the country in the New Deal. And that was the telephone co-ops, the electric co-ops, and other community-based municipal services that the New Deal created, because the capitalists did not want to invest money in rural areas, even though Roosevelt said, we'll give you the money, because you can't make a buck. The return was not there. So when the Roosevelt people were shocked that they wouldn't even take the money to set up the power lines, et cetera, they thought of, well, why not just have local nonprofits form and we'll set up local power distribution companies? And that's what services 80% of the United States and is hardly ever talked about. Now, when I bring this up to people, some people in the know, they'll say, well, these rural co-ops are run by the good old boys. They're reactionary. They like nuclear power and think we should get back into nuclear power and all that. That's all irrelevant to the fact that these electric co-ops are run locally, democratically, and have never screwed up on delivering the power, which is fulfilling their mission. It doesn't matter whether the locals have goofy politics. That's no reason to be against electric co-ops. And they have goofy politics because we've abandoned them. So that's all I did was just, that was the solution I played to, is said we could create co-ops in the forest for the forest landscape. There would have to be screws turned on the timber, Wall Street timber boys, which could happen. There's lots of ways a coherent federal government can turn screws on any industry. Just enforce the law might be the first screw to turn. But, and then provide the money in the form of grants that would come with a easement attached to the property that says, all you have to do is grow forest to longer rotations. This was not a proposal saying end cutting or end timber. This was a transition to build up carbon, and all the issues such as aerial spraying or herbicides or all kinds of issues could be fought out locally and resolved locally, not preempted, not whatever. And I think we'd end up with a lot of good outcomes, and we'd end up with a new infrastructure of ownership on the lands that would be doing a much better forestry. And the most important thing, or one of the most important things, is the cash flow that now goes out of the timberlands. And this is a report we came out with, a Follow the Money report in May, which you can download off the front page of the Coast Range website. Today, these organizations, these TIMOs and REITs and whatever, what are they doing? What's their purpose is to send money to the investors. Well, who are the investors? The investors of equity and the owners of equity in the United States, if you want to just go with the rule of thumb, is this. 60% of equity is owned by the 1%. 90% of equity is owned by the top 10%. So that's where these lands are sending their money, either in the form of interest payments to bondholders or dividends to shareholders or stock options to the rich top of the management. Well, that's a hell of a purpose to have these timberlands dedicated to, is the wealthiest people in the United States or the world at the same time screwing down the carbon content because return, the economics of return dictates that kind of forestry, and then lowering costs by doing everything you can to screw over the workers, spray pesticides or whatever. So I thought, let's transition. It wasn't a radical proposal, and it wasn't something that was going to freak out the locals. They're familiar with ownerships like this. And so that's it. That's the Green New Deal proposal. You can read about it, whatever. But given yesterday, I just wanted to make a couple of points. The folks that showed up here yesterday are just a small little subgroup. Let me get this up there. 57,000 venture capital firms. So we saw a few folks here yesterday. 25,000 private equity firms. This is global in the PitchBook database that you can access. Almost 500,000 investors. Almost 300,000, this is their words, strategic acquirers. This is what we're up against. And we make these differences amongst ourselves and parse this, and I'm not going to work with you about that. And all the while, the planet's going right towards the brink because of this monolith. And I just don't get it. We ought to all be on the same program in a very general way and not arguing about details. Because the creative destruction by the people from Planet Capital is happening every day on every community. We're losing more small landowners to these big capital outfits. Lord knows what's going on in domains I don't even study. Healthcare, housing. 1 out of 7 homes in Portland is being bought by these guys. You know, they're everywhere, making it more difficult for people. And, you know, the idea that this is about capitalism is well explored in literature. I mean, Milton Friedman wrote about it. The right wing has a lot of literature about capitalism is the best thing since sliced bread. And there's a great body of literature about capitalism from the left. I think there's a deficiency of understanding what this is all about, this economic system we have. And we ought to be about the business of learning more about it and getting more conversant, like we are conversant about fire ecology, forest biology, ecosystem processes. Because this is really what's tearing up the place and sending us over the edge with the climate crisis. And I don't have an ending, thank you.
So right now we can have questions, observations, thoughts for Chuck, and thank you for all that work. It's so good.
Well, the state is kind of positioning itself. I don't know if it's exactly with the natural solutions legislation. I think that's creating some platform that could accept money from the federal government that the Biden administration has out of that $1 trillion-plus appropriation, of which I think $300 billion or more is for climate. Here's the point that needs to be understood, is that the scale of this transition we need to go through can only be financed by the federal government. States can only spend what they collect in taxes or borrow. The federal government can take a loan against the future with whatever money, with any amount of money. And so I think, as Keynes once said, if it can be done, it can be paid for. If it can't be done, you can't pay for it. You'll end up with inflation.
Have you thought about how to deal with speculation into the future, scale of money that it costs?
Well, the question is, how to deal with the future problem of the cost of land and the scale of what it would take to acquire land. Well, a little bit of history there is that asset inflation went part and parcel with the Federal Reserve running the discount rate down to zero so that the rich folks could get free money, or at least the big banks could get free money, and then lend it out at a very cheap rate. Well, once you can do that, all kinds of people would borrow money not me, but borrow money and go buy land and have Hancock run it or something like that. You know, you could buy assets with cheap money. And so we had 10 years of asset inflation. Now, as interest rates go up, we'll see that asset inflation end. Maybe asset prices go down. So I don't know. But, the prices of assets and the ability to mobilize cash in a free money regime, the rich folks went nuts. It wasn't the poor folks. Okay, in the back.
I really enjoyed this conversation. And I just wanted to invite you to build on one point that you made, which is that really frequently there's this urban-rural divide between big means and cultivation means. And the assumption seems to be that the only alternative to Wall Street is the control of forest and land from D.C. or from Salem. And what you're saying, I think, is that it's really local communities that are directly invested in the land itself that needs to be the ones making those decisions. And I think there's a lot of fear in urban communities that those are right-wingers, that there's distrust. And so that's legitimate, and understandable. There's been a real breakdown in our society. So what is your experience? I mean, to me, that seems like an organizing opportunity and urban economy. What have you been the successes that you've seen in organizing local communities to engage with the lands around them in ways that are more in line with the revolutionary movement?
Well, you just have to look at U.S. history. You have to look at the 1890s and the populist movements in the prairie, railing against the grain monopolies and the railroad, the monopolies that were, ripping people off. And they would get the Republican farmers to vote for the socialists. it could happen again. You got to have the underlying material condition has to be there. People have to be hurting and pissed about real things. And then you have to have people with a good analysis that understand the system explaining to people this is where the problem lies. The problem does not lie in a few people coming across the border. The problem does not lie in people that don't look like you. You live in a capitalist system, and there's the main thing happening is the class struggle between the folks that got all the stuff and everyone else that just has to run on the squirrel cage treadmill. Well, once you can get that across, let's get on the same program and deal with where the problem lies.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. You can learn more about Who Will Own the Forest, our Forests Over Profits movement to stop corporate exploitation of our forest lands and communities, all of that at forestsoverprofits.org. And, of course, the home for all of your anti-Wall Street timberland needs and so much more is the Coast Range Association at coastrange.org. If you like what we're doing, make sure you're subscribed to the Coast Range Radio podcast feed, which you can find wherever you listen to podcasts, and recommend the show to a friend. My email is michael@coastrange.org. Feel free to drop me a line and let me know what you think of the show, future topic ideas, or just to say hi. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We'll be back soon. Thank you.
with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're nearing the end of our fall membership drive. We only have a few days left to meet our $55,000 goal, and you can do your part by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s. And Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts,